Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hi, everybody. We welcome you back to Close Up Talk Radio. Nice to have you with us today. We're excited because Jeff Kernan is back with us. He was here a week ago. He is, I guess the best way to put it, he's a cop's cop. He has done everything you can think of almost in his 32-year experience in police and law enforcement. I'm not going to give you a whole list of things that he's done because it covers everything. But he has been a detective sergeant. Well, he started as a cop on the beat. He went from that to becoming a deputy sheriff. And then based on the number of arrests he made in 1 year, over 200, he was engaged by the DEA, based in San Jose, California, as a task force officer to assist in a heroin task force. Hear that? Telephone is going off. That should never happen. But it does happen, and it just did. Now it's quiet as can be. Anyway, Jeff back again. You know, the best thing to tell you about is really what he's doing today. He specializes in expert witness consultation, depositions, and court testimony. As an expert witness, he specializes in this very heavily. He's also an instructor for the California Association of Tactical Trainers that is structured to provide law enforcement and public safety training through the California State Law Enforcement Training, and on contact directly with various agencies. Currently, he's engaged in presenting courses of instruction through the Criminal Justice Training Centers throughout the Western United States. He's done so much. He's been a SWAT officer heading a SWAT team. He's well-versed in police training and the requirements to operate a SWAT team. He's been there, and he's done it. He's based now down in Texas, in Grapevine, Texas, which is in the Dallas area, and it's a great opportunity to chat with him about what he does and to learn more about exactly what he is involved in as an expert witness, which he does a lot. Jeff, welcome back. Nice to have you with us. How are you today?
Good morning. Thank you for having me back. I'm doing well. Thank you. Happy to be in Texas.
Listen, I know you recently moved from California down to Texas. What prompted the move, by the way? Were you just getting tired of the heat? You know, it gets pretty hot around Dallas, too.
not as hot as it is in California right now. We have young daughters, and we wanted to get them into a better school district and more things for them to do here to help them thrive in their younger years.
Well, good for you. Probably a very wise decision. You know, I referred to you a couple of minutes ago as a cop's cop, and I was thinking a while ago, where did the term cop come from? I can't figure it out. Do you know the where it started?
Well, initially, police work or law enforcement was the constables in the United Kingdom. The term cop was just... I think it's just an acronym or a short version of a police officer. I don't know the exact history of the word itself. I'd probably have to do a Webster's dictionary search. So you got me on that one on my first question.
We're in the same boat. Let me ask you one other question.
Yeah.
Do policemen object to being referred to as a cop?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
It's an American
okay,
term.
Good. Okay, good. I didn't know whether they're not. It's good to know.
We've been
called worse.
Let
me talk a little bit about your work as an expert witness. Goodness gracious, you've got so much experience. You'd be great as an expert witness in court cases. Obviously, you do this primarily specializing in the police use of force in policy and negligent security cases. Tell me a little bit about police use of force. What is your understanding of police use of force?
Well, use of force in this context refers to the physical action itself, exactly how an officer applies physical or mechanical force against a person. And that could be something as simple as a light touch, a wrist lock, baton strike, a foot sweep, up to mechanical devices like a taser, and up to and including deadly force when necessary. What's relevant to this conversation is every search and arrest of a person is considered to be a Fourth Amendment seizure, regardless of whether physical force is used or not. The fact that the person has been searched or arrested is considered the seizure and is constitutionally recognized as a use of force under the Fourth Amendment. There are levels of force that police use. And, it starts at the lowest level, which is like an officer's presence, dialogue or verbal direction. Then, like I said earlier, light touch. Then there's verbal or passive physical noncompliance that we often deal with. And then it escalates from there, which we refer to as a continuum of force, which includes restraint devices, sometimes like in a custodial facility or an environment, takedowns, the use of pain compliance that our defensive tactics instructors train officers how to use, and so forth. So does that help answer your question?
It does, yeah. You know, when we hear stories about you know, law enforcement and involved in arresting, you know, suspects in various situations, you know, the media talks a lot about use of force tactics that sometimes they use, and you know what I'm talking about. Let me ask you something. What is it the media never talks about? How would you answer that?
Well, the media does not talk about. Well, my personal opinion is I often ask the question, why is the media not interested? They often talk about police shootings and the questionable use of force tactics, right? We see that on the news almost on a daily basis. But what the media is not interested in is cops dying while they're doing their job, and they're only interested in when cops shoot somebody while they're doing their job. And I ask myself, is this the media simply controlling these narratives? I'd like to share with you that every week a law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty. The frequency of law enforcement officer deaths does not decrease each year here in the United States. There's actually a web page and a mobile app called Officer Down Memorial Page that you can download, and it tracks recently fallen officers throughout the United States, specifically by state and by recently fallen. And when we did our first interview on May 5th, when I was preparing, I looked back and we had lost 105 law enforcement officers at that time, which equates to almost one per day. Since then, and checking today's data, we lost 169 officers. So 64 officers have died in the line of duty between these two interviews. In 2019, we lost 157 officers. And in 2020, that increased to 188 officers. And that's not counting other causes of death like suicide and exposure that are often not in the same category.
Right.
The FBI does a great job with their statistics, and they track law enforcement officers assaulted and killed in the line of duty each year. And last year, 59 police officers were killed in the line of duty just from January to September of 2021, which marked a 51% increase in the number of police officers killed when compared to the same period the prior year. But one thing that no one hears about, they always hear about, you hear about like three officers got shot, but you hear about the one that got killed. But what about the two that got shot? And that's what you don't hear about. Nationally, 60,105 law enforcement officers were assaulted while performing their duties in just year 2020 alone. These assaults were reported to the FBI by almost 10,000 law enforcement agencies. And based on those reports, there were 4,000 more officers assaulted in 2020 than the 56,000 assaults that were reported in 2019. So that's what the media does not talk about, and that's what really bothers people in our profession when we see the negativity that's out there, but they don't see the reality of what police work does to the families of these officers.
That's really very, very interesting. That website, by the way, Officer Down Memorial Page, ODMP, I guess that's .com, I would assume. Were you one of the ones behind starting it? You referred to it when you got it on.
No, it's been out for a while, and I'm just one of the many folks that unfortunately look at that, which I don't like doing, but it's kind of we need to remind ourselves the inherent danger of the profession.
That's very important. You know so much about so many different areas. Let's talk a little bit about private security. We hear the term negligent security. Define that for me. What is negligent security? How would you answer that?
Well, that's a good question because that's a lot of my cases I've been getting recently through the expert testimony work is negligent security cases. Negligent security it falls under premise liability that deals with which is in the civil code during civil lawsuits, which deals with holding property owners liable for any damages or injuries that occur on their property due to a lack of reasonable safety or security measures. An example is I always use the reasonable person example. If you're a patron, a visitor, or an employee, you have a reasonable expectation of safety and security when entering a business or property. That's the basic expectation that you would have. And
right.
Failing to exercise the standard of care expected of a reasonably prudent person in like circumstances. And that's where businesses fall short when they take shortcuts on their security programs. A business can take steps to minimize the risks of foreseeable violent crimes, as simple as security camera installations, security gates, adequate lighting. Negligent security can include lack of security, improper surveillance, complacent, not security guards who are not trained, not staffed appropriately. If it's predictable, it's preventable. It's just the risk appetite businesses choose to take based on their insurance policies, and that's where they take their shortcuts, right? Because they're saving money here, and then they cross their fingers and hope it doesn't happen on their watch. But more or less, in a nutshell, that's what negligent security falls under.
You make it sound like every shop, every store should have a security officer inside who can do something to help prevent them from having, you know, suffering some kind of injury or damage if anything should go wrong. Obviously, you know, there are very few stores you go in where you see that kind of security. And in this day and age when, you know, you see all these people just running in and you know, robbing a store of millions of dollars worth of merchandise in 2 or 3 minutes, and it's happening all over the country, it's really hard for the merchants to prevent some of these things from happening. Wouldn't you agree?
It is. Again, it depends on there's a key phrase that's called crime prevention through environmental design. And when new buildings are being put up during the permitting and building process, they're including that piece so that they can look at crime prevention before the building's even up. And that seems to help. And then a lot of state laws have been amended, and a lot of these crimes are now looked at as insurance claims, and they're not being prosecuted as they were in the past. Specifically, California has amended a lot of their laws and downgraded felonies to misdemeanors, which caused a spike in crime and property crimes because they are looked at as insurance claims now and not as cases that police would normally follow up on in the past.
You know, let's talk a little bit about your being an expert witness. I've talked to other people from other industries who have become expert witnesses, these chemists and lawyers. No, well, not lawyers. Take them out. But people in various industries who, doctors, for example, physicists and people like that who get involved, brought in to help testify in cases, you know, that involve their expertise. As a police officer, I would assume throughout the years you've been involved in having to come into court cases and testify, and you therefore probably have experienced the joy of having an attorney trying to twist your words and get you flummoxed on the witness stand. Maybe I'm assuming, but anyway, what's it like from your perspective being an expert witness now? In a situation like that, we see it on television all the time where people are being grilled by by lawyers who are very aggressive. What's it like for you to go through that? And I'm sure you have. How about it?
It's part of the, you know, it keeps you sharp. It's part of the challenge, right? It's part of the fun. I love getting cross-examined by defense attorneys. I actually would tell them, I owed them a beer after my cross-examination. They did such a fine job in shredding me while I was on the stand. And they make you a better witness. They make you a better cop because they expose things that maybe I didn't think about, right, or that I didn't do or that I could have done better. But as an expert, you're in a different seat because you render an opinion, an expert opinion, and it has to be based off of a methodology that is used, based off of reliable principles and methods, based off of sufficient facts or data. Usually that's from discovery materials that are produced by attorneys during the course of a lawsuit. Excuse me. And it has to be reliably applied, the principles and methods, to the facts of the case. And you have to be able to successfully deliver your expert opinion, or belief during a deposition. The deposition is that's where you earn your money, because the attorneys keep you in the seat for as long as they want, hours to days, to discredit you, so they can kick you off the case and benefit their side of the argument. So I enjoy it, even though it sounds kind of crazy. But it's I do. I enjoy the work. I believe in the work that I do. I was introduced to expert witness work from a mentor of mine, Mr. Ben Tisa. He's a retired FBI SWAT guy. He was one of our trainers, and he's been an expert witness for more than 30 years across the country. And he's taught me a lot of how to be a good expert witness, and I owe a lot of my success to him.
Give us an idea of the kind of cases you would be brought in to testify on as an expert witness. Are they ones that always involve, in some way involve police, excess use of force by police or something like that, or not? It could be pretty broad. Give me an idea.
Yeah, it is. We use this median called SEEK, expert witness directory, that a lot of law firms refer to when they're looking for an expert. And like you said, most experts come from the medical field because of the medical malpractice lawsuits and whatnot. But there is a small niche of law enforcement and security folks, and me being one of them. And cases that I'll be brought in on is usually a policy and procedural questions that come up during an investigation or a lawsuit. Use of force, police use of force, security negligence, like we talked about. I just recently picked up a case in Sacramento regarding a sex assault at a school district. I have two cases right now in Las Vegas regarding a lawsuit against two casinos regarding their security programs. And then I have a case in Florida regarding a police shooting, a shootout that occurred during a service of a narcotic search warrant where the police officers are going to trial. So it just depends. I do get a lot of calls. I don't take all the cases. I just take the ones that I believe in and that are winnable. And I work for either side, the defense or the plaintiff, so that I remain unbiased and not one-sided during my testimonies.
Give me an idea how much work it is involved for you when you get in, when you actually agree to participate in a case. It's not something, I would assume you have to do a lot of preparation and going through all the facts and stuff involving the case before you ever get to the courtroom or wherever the depositions are being taken. Wouldn't that be right? A lot of work for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I was up till 2 a.m. this morning just working on a rebuttal statement on a case that's been ongoing. So I think when you first pick up a case, you do an attorney conference to learn a little bit about it. You look at the complaint, and then there's this discovery documents that are sent to you, including depositions. Depositions can be 300 pages long as a normal deposition, I may get a dozen of those policies, procedures. And then I have research material. I have a whole library of bookshelves of just research material on best practices and textbooks that I use as references when forming an opinion. So I have a basis of the opinion. So it's not just coming from me. It's coming from practitioners and proven resources in the industries. So it just takes some time to put the research together and make your notes and review the documents. So you can put in several hours on one case, and then the deposition can take several hours, and there's preparation time for the deposition as well. So it goes on. It's like court cases, right? They just never end. They just keep getting.
I was going to ask you how many of these cases that you get called in to work on actually go to trial. A lot of them I know get settled before they ever get to trial, but how about your experience?
Every case has a threat of a trial date, and they actually do have trial dates on calendar, but they do get pushed. And not often do they happen when they say they do. They get pushed out for years sometimes because of more discovery that's coming through and back and forth with litigations and depositions between the two attorney groups. I would say 80% or more go to depositions. Maybe 100% go to depositions, and then the trial it diminishes at that point, because a lot of these civil lawsuits have a price tag on them, and if there's an agreeable amount, then they can save each other the time and the effort to go to trial. But some of the bigger cases do go to trial, so it's a hard one to put a number on. But you're right, a lot of them don't.
Any one specific case come to mind as being a really intriguing case for you to have been involved in? How would you answer that?
Every case has its has an appeal or an intrigue factor. What I like is looking at the opposition, the other experts that are brought in. That rebut my statement, or that I have to rebut their opinions, and I learn from them, from their style, their technique, their research, and their CVs, their curriculum vitae, their resumes, and I find that part intriguing. On learning from the opposition, the case itself, I'm not at liberty to discuss a lot of them because there a lot of them are still live or in litigation, but none of them are really good.
Yeah.
none of them are really good news. It's usually, some kind of tragedy or some kind of grievous injury that happened to somebody. And, you're there just to try to help them along in life and get them compensated for the pain and suffering or whatever happened to them.
You've been in this field for so long, more than 30 years. Of all the various positions you held as a police officer, I mean, from, as a SWAT officer to, a police, being a police assistant police chief or being a police officer on the beat or the various specialty positions you held, what did you find the most interesting and the most memorable for you at this point in your career as you look back? How would you answer that?
No, I would just say it's the people that I came across, the people that I worked with, worked for, people I mentored, and then the community folks, the people who I was able to help. I can't help everybody, but you try. Some people I did make a difference in their lives, and I'm proud of that, and I still keep in touch with a lot of those folks to this day. So I think if you're asking for like a proud accomplishment, it would just be helping people throughout my career and the different capacities that I had during the course of my career.
And for the most part, you were in California, up in the northern, in the Bay Area, San Jose, in that area, right? For the most part, and that it's a pretty tough area. San Jose can be tough.
Crime has no jurisdiction, right? It goes with the winds, but looks for opportunity, but. Most of my career was San Mateo County, which is a beautiful place to live and work. It's a peninsula there between San Francisco and San Jose, but we are surrounded by big cities, San Jose, Oakland, and San Francisco, and we do get some spillover in regards to narcotics trafficking and gang activity and other crimes. So, yeah, we keep busy.
So in addition to working, you know, in the field of expert witness testimony, you have your own company. How do you spend your time, most of your time now? You've been so involved, and you are still so involved. Mm-hmm. What do you do primarily now?
I like the expert witness work. I really enjoy that. So I usually have a couple of cases that I'm working on. I just finished one early this morning. I have two others I have in front of me. But I also do contract work for security companies, and I assist them with investigations in other county government agencies. I assist with investigations. I also have this church security group that I do threat and vulnerability assessments for churches and help them bolster their security or build a security program for their churches. And I consult with an insurance company that actually provides insurance to churches in the state of California and Nevada. And I do webinars, and then I meet with churches. I met with four churches just last week, a few in San Diego, one in Northern California, and then one in San Antonio, helping them to teach them how to get grant money, because the state and the federal government through DHS FEMA provide grant money to houses of worship, any denomination, any faith group. They will give up to $200,000. State of California, state of Nevada gives up to $450,000, and DHS FEMA gives $100,000 per year to churches who qualify through a grant application. And so I help them through that process so that they can have a safer place for their congregations to meet.
That's by the way, that website is Church Security Solutions. You help them understand what the threat assessment is, I guess, in that specific church. And I guess those grants help them to be able to hire security officers and to learn really what they need to do to protect their parishioners when they're coming to church. Isn't that right? Would that be about right?
It is. It's just not for security officers. That's just one piece of the pie. You want to look at it as a layered approach. It helps with building an emergency operations plan, training, education, bringing in equipment, whether it's cameras or locks or gates. If they have a school or a nursery, it'll help with that. So there's a lot of things that the government authorizes under what's called an approved equipment list. And it's all listed in my website, churchsecuritysolutions.org, for that piece of what I do.
Well, I think that's very worthwhile considering, and it's something really I never really thought about. So obviously you'd be an ideal one to guide a church on, no question about it. Listen, it's fascinating what you do. I know you've had an amazing career, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to tell us a little bit about exactly what it's like to be an expert witness in your area of the law, and talk about your career and what you've been doing. It's been pretty fascinating. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. I want everybody to know you do have a website. It's jeffkernan.com. Jeff Kernan, KEARNAN.com. And, you know, hopefully we'll talk again someday. Thank you so much for your time, Jeff. Okay?
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's very nice having you with us, indeed. There's a gentleman who knows so much about the world of law and the world of being a police officer in so many different areas and jurisdictions. It's amazing, and we thank him so much for being with us. And that'll wrap it up for this edition of Close Up Talk Radio, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be back with us again, because we do these kinds of broadcasts with amazing people almost every day. Thanks for being with us. Take care now, and we'll talk to you next time. Till then, bye-bye.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.